The American continents are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers. We should consider any attempt on their part to extend their system to any portion of this hemisphere as dangerous to our peace and safety. These were the words of President James Monroe, delivered in his annual message to the United States Congress in December 1823. Monroe's message, calling on European empires to abstain from interference in the Western Hemisphere, has a long and complicated afterlife in American statecraft. How should we understand the history of the Monroe Doctrine? And what is its significance in the American geopolitical imagination? I'm Jack Dickens, commissioning editor at Engelsberg Ideas. With me to discuss the Monroe Doctrine and its legacy is Charlie Lederman, senior lecturer in international history at King's College London and an associate professor at the University of Florida's Hamilton Center. Charlie, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be with you, Jack.
Now, Charlie, you're joining us from Florida, so you're currently embedded in the historical heartlands of the Monroe Doctrine, very close to places such as Caracas, Colombia, and Cuba. From where you're sitting, did President Trump's recent intervention in Venezuela usher in some kind of watershed moment in the history of US foreign policy?
Well, thank you, Jack. And as I say, I think Florida is almost the ideal place to be looking at some of these questions at the moment, particularly as we might be experiencing what could be called the Floridification of American foreign policy in recent years, with a Secretary of State who was a senator here, but in general, a sense that the Western Hemisphere is far more the centerpiece of American foreign policy. And to be honest, that was the case for the vast majority of American history, certainly the first 150 years of America's existence. The Western Hemisphere was the core strategic interest of the United States, of ensuring that no European powers could threaten the American position, first continentally in the United States, and then more broadly in the wider hemisphere. So to a certain extent, what we've seen in recent weeks and months is almost a reversion to an earlier version of Americans' conception of its statecraft and its strategy. Now, of course, there are certain innovations, which I'm sure we'll get to, but to a certain extent, and perhaps in ways not always fully appreciated, and perhaps even unconsciously by the president himself, he's tapping into a much longer tradition in American statecraft, where Latin America and the Western Hemisphere is the real sort of fulcrum of America's place in the world.
And the president obviously christened his action as being part of the Monroe Doctrine, and he was obviously drawing on some of these long traditions, centuries-long traditions in American statecraft. So bringing it back to the Monroe Doctrine, as it was originally formulated in 1823, what are the key principles of President James Monroe's ideals and mission? And can you give us some of the sense of the wider geopolitical context in which the Monroe Doctrine was articulated?
Absolutely. And the Monroe Doctrine, it's a very grand name, but it wasn't necessarily at the time seen as this sort of grand statement. It wasn't the Monroe Doctrine as we understand it, say the capitalized Monroe Doctrine. It was actually just a few non-sequential paragraphs in a wider annual statement. And this was a time where American presidents didn't deliver states of the union. It wasn't sort of something where you've got sort of all these dignitaries in Congress. This was a written message, which was it was in the aftermath of Thomas Jefferson's time in office that we moved away from this idea. Jefferson saw it as sort of monarchical to come before Congress and deliver these sort of big sort of set piece speeches. So it was a written statement, 6,000 words that goes out, and really, what Monroe is doing is responding to a seismic geopolitical shift that had occurred in the Western Hemisphere over the years before, but to which the United States was actually very much a bit part player. We have to remember the United States as this sort of fledgling republic of this era, and has trying to avoid as much as possible embroilment, as George Washington talked about, in the power politics of Europe, that essentially for the United States to survive as an independent republic in a world dominated by European empires, the US needed to avoid becoming too entangled in these big questions. And what happens in Latin America in the early 1820s is a independence movement that sort of spreads across the continent from the Spanish Empire. But back in Europe, you get the emergence of this Holy Alliance between the more conservative states in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars, and the Bourbon of France becomes connected to. And when France moves into Spain in the early 1820s, there's great fears that the European powers are going to try to reverse those independence movements that have occurred in the American continent. And the United States is concerned about this, but actually has very little power to do anything about it. But the other power that is particularly concerned about this is the British Empire. And it's really the British Empire that's the fundamental actor in this story, because they have the power to ensure that the other European powers don't intervene across the Atlantic. So as George Canning, the famed British statesman, will say at this point, that he sort of calls the New World into existence to address the balance of the old. And part of this is about the idea of a joint statement with the United States to avoid European intervention, but it's also about the recognition of these Latin American republics. And Monroe's doctrine, which is actually not largely written by Monroe himself, comes about in this context. So I'd be happy to talk a bit more about who writes it, what it's written for, and the sort of domestic political considerations of this.
Yes, I would actually like to turn to the drafting of the annual message in which what we call the Monroe Doctrine today first appeared. And as you say, this wasn't just President James Monroe producing this declaration. It was a very collaborative endeavour between the president and the cabinet at the time. And one very important figure in that cabinet was the Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams. Can you tell us why he's important to the history of the Monroe Doctrine?
Yes, we tend to think of John Quincy Adams today in ways where it's all, again, he's sort of reduced, a bit like Monroe himself, to sort of a few lines that he uttered at around this time. So we tend to think of John Quincy Adams as the man who invokes this idea of America not going abroad in search of monsters to destroy. And there's a number of American think tanks that have emerged in recent years, the Quincy Institute being one of them, that upholds this idea and says, well, we're more restrainerish, we're acting in the John Quincy Adams tradition of not going abroad in search of monsters to destroy. Now, that's one part of John Quincy Adams' legacy, but it should be seen in its rounder whole, because John Quincy Adams, just like the founding fathers before him, is concerned about the American experiment and the threat to it from the European powers. So from an early point in his career, from when he's minister to Russia, he's concerned about the Russian encroachment into the Western Hemisphere. And really what we're seeing in the early 1820s is his fear that the US shouldn't go and project power into the European continent, as some are calling for at that time. So when Quincy Adams in 1821 talks about this idea of not going abroad in search of monsters to destroy, he's concerned that many Americans are caught up in the fervour for the Greek independence cause in the Ottoman Empire. And so John Quincy Adams says, we don't go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. Our focus has got to be on the Western Hemisphere. That's where the threat to our existence and to our security will come into being. So then 2 years later, after that statement that he makes on the monsters to destroy, that's when you're getting this approach from the British based around the Holy Alliance saying, why don't we have this joint statement to ensure that the European powers stay out of the Western Hemisphere? And John Quincy Adams is concerned that the British could be an agent of intervention in the Western Hemisphere as the Holy Alliance power. So John Quincy Adams does not want a joint statement with the British on this. He wants an independent statement with regard to this. He's concerned also about America's control of the continental United States. It's been around this time that James Monroe has purchased Florida. And so the idea of the US expanding across the Western Hemisphere, stopping other European powers from meddling on the continent, but also more broadly in the Western Hemisphere. So John Quincy Adams is really the author of those passages in the Monroe Doctrine that states, essentially, this is a unilateral statement by the United States. It's for political consumption at home. And it's about this idea that essentially the US will not intervene in Europe about the sort of sort of things that we've just talked about with regard to the Greeks in the Ottoman Empire, that it's not going to go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. But as a sort of quid pro quo, the Europeans had to stay out of the Western Hemisphere as well. So it's a symbolic statement more than anything, because John Quincy Adams knows that actually the US does not have the naval power if the European powers were to intervene, and that the British Empire is going to be important for upholding that. But he wants a statement to go out that's about America's unilateral claim to its ability to project power into the Western Hemisphere, not one that would allow the Europeans to have essentially carte blanche to intervene in the Americas.
And is this idea of isolating the Americas from the entanglements of European politics underpinned by a certain worldview, dare I say a certain religious worldview, and a sense of America and the New World as being a land free from the blemishes of the Old World?
Absolutely. So it's tied in with what the historian Walter McDougall talks about as America's civic religion. There's very much that there as well. But what's really interesting about the Monroe Doctrine from a very early point is that the political symbolism, it's such a capacious doctrine that different aspects of the American political scene are able to pour their ideas into it. So John Quincy Adams is a believer in emancipation for slaves. He sees it as part of America's sort of liberal mission, small L liberal, of its liberal government, but also a sense that this is about protecting the American experiment, and it's also about ensuring that other powers don't intervene on behalf of sectional interests in the United States. Now, for someone like John C. Calhoun, who's Secretary of War at this time, this is about protecting America's, or the South's particular peculiar institution with regard to slavery. So there's all sorts of different political constituencies that are fighting over the definition of the Monroe Doctrine. And this is also playing out in these early years. And to a great extent, the British are looking at this with regard to their sense of their sort of informal empire in Latin America. This is about preventing the Europeans intervening, but also so that British economic interests are expanded in Latin America. So it's not just like the British aren't protecting the Monroe Doctrine as a form of altruism to the United States. It's doing so on the basis of its own economic interests, its access to things like American cotton as well, but also with regard to the markets of Latin America as well. So there's all different actors have their own interests in the Monroe Doctrine, which, as I say, is a very elevated statement, but is quite light on detail, and certainly light from the American sense on the ability to actually uphold it.
And are American statesmen thinking of the United States as an empire at this stage, or is that something that comes later?
There's the sort of Thomas Jefferson idea of sort of empire of liberty, and there's certainly this idea of the US desire to expand across the continent, but not necessarily an idea of the US intervening sort of far and wide across the hemisphere. I mean, what has to be remembered, though, is that the United States has what the historian C. Van Woodward would call free security during this period. It has relatively, well, apart from obviously you've got the British in Canada, so that's a potential great power there. You've got the Spanish in Cuba, but it's a hostile world. But throughout the 19th century, if we come to look back on this, America's geopolitical position is far more advantageous than that of almost any other power in the world, particularly when these sort of Latin American republics have moved towards independence. So it doesn't face the same sort of threats that Europe faces at that point. Even if the US, as I say, is a fledgling republic, the ability to project power across the Atlantic is a much harder thing to do than, say, what we're seeing in continental Europe, where there's a whole sort of hodgepodge of great powers sort of competing with each other strategically. And really what the United States is trying to do is to protect the fact that it's blessed by geography. And what we start to see, and where the Monroe Doctrine really revolutionizes by the end of the 19th century, is the sense the US may no longer be blessed by geography, that the European powers are intervening in Africa, they're intervening in Asia, they're carving up the rest of the world, and are they going to return to the Western Hemisphere to carve that up as well? So it's as much about American anxiety as it is about American belief in dominating the Western Hemisphere, even if there are some who look at this idea of this sort of empire of liberty that will stretch into the future.
And what impact does Monroe's annual message have on the European powers at the time? Does it really have that big an impact on the geopolitics of the Atlantic. You've said already that, to all intents and purposes, Great Britain is the power that matters in this period, and especially British naval power. How do the other European countries and European empires perceive what Monroe and his administration have drafted?
They pay very little attention to it at that time. And the Americans are aware of this. I mean, there's some in the cabinet who say to Adams, well, the really important question that we've got to work out is what happens if these powers call our bluff? What if the Holy Alliance ignores the message that they intervene in Spanish America? Can the US fight? And essentially, it's British power and diplomacy that spares the United States from having to answer that question. That's the really important thing. So the US is concerned really from sort of a soft power perspective, because the US has recognized these republics ahead of Britain. So Canning moves to this in the aftermath of the Monroe Declaration. So there's certainly a sort of a political sense of this. And the British are concerned sort of long term down the line that the US will essentially have this appeal with its democratic government to these new sort of Republican Latin American states that might gravitate towards the United States in the Western Hemisphere. But for the most part, at this point, it's not a big part of European geopolitics. It's that the British have this interest in Latin America moving from a more formalized empire in the sort of old form to a more important part in the British informal empire. And that's the really important aspect of this. It's British power. This is fundamentally about Britain as the most important actor in Atlantic geopolitics at this stage, rather than the United States.
So the 1820s pass by and the Monroe Doctrine sort of recedes into the background for a few decades. However, interest in the annual message and what Monroe said revives again in the 19th century periodically. When exactly does interest in the doctrine revive and why?
Yeah, it comes back to a sense of strategic uncertainty and a sense about security. So particularly during the American Civil War, when the French move into Mexico, putting Emperor Maximilian on the throne, that's when the Americans again are particularly concerned. I mean, there's some talk in 1864 that potentially that the US should sort of park the Civil War and actually have to deal with what's going on in Mexico and potentially then sort of revert to sort of fighting the Civil War again afterwards. But the sense is, well, this is about the Europeans taking advantage of what's going on the American continent and the French intervention there. So that's a time where we do start to see American statesmen providing arms and providing resources to the Mexicans fighting off the French. But really in the aftermath of the Civil War, we sort of revert to this idea where the US doesn't want a standing army. It doesn't sort of keep building up its navy. It's really during the Gilded Age that we see the US in its most isolationist phase to a great extent. And so then we get to this point in sort of the 1880s and 1890s, where, as I mentioned, the world is being carved up again by these European empires, and the US is extremely concerned. I mean, it has a navy that's smaller in size than that of the Ottoman Empire and Austria-Hungary. There's a potential naval dispute with Chile at the beginning of the 1890s. It's not clear that the US has a more powerful navy than Chile. So it's not even clear that the US is the dominant power in its own hemisphere. And that's when we start to see a belief that the US needs to sort of build back up again. It needs to build up its navy in particular, and it needs to ensure that European powers can no longer just act willy-nilly in this. And particularly, there's a sense for some statesmen by the sort of turn of the 20th century that the British Empire is on the downgrade and that the US can no longer rely, even as we've had all of these. I mean, for many American statesmen, we have the sort of the twisting of the lion's tail, this constant sort of poking the finger at the British and using it in domestic politics, even though the smartest American statesmen during this period recognized that actually British naval power is pretty important to America's own interests. So if the British start to decline, then what's going to happen to the European hemisphere, the Western hemisphere? Are the Europeans again going to be setting up their colonies there? And what does that mean for American security?
And significantly, in light of recent events, the doctrine was reasserted in the 1890s and 1900s in the context of border disputes and then a debt crisis in Venezuela. Can you tell us a bit more about what's going on there at the turn of the 20th century?
Yeah, huge irony, isn't it, that it's actually Venezuela that's at the centre of a much more assertive American presence in the Western Hemisphere during this period. And so, as you say, the 1895 Venezuelan boundary dispute is a real sort of touchstone in the emergence of the US as a more interventionist power in its region. And this, the Venezuelan boundary dispute, has been going back for a number of years, like into the early 19th century, where the British have had their colony in British Guyana, and the Venezuelans are concerned of increasing encroachment by the British, particularly when gold is discovered in the border regions between the two. And so the Venezuelans start sort of appealing to the United States to sort of start getting serious about the Monroe Doctrine from about the 1860s onwards. But as I say, in that period during the Gilded Age, there's a sense that the Americans are like, well, yeah, perhaps we can rely on arbitration, perhaps we can rely on sort of these sort of softer pacts. But there's no real sense of like that military power is going to be necessary to do this. And the Venezuelans are sending all manner of agents to the United States to try and encourage the United States to sort of recognize the significance of this. And what happens under President Grover Cleveland and his Secretary of State, in particular, Richard Olney, is that in 1894, 1895, as I say, when you're getting this carving up of the world elsewhere, Olney basically sends a message to the British and says, we are the dominant power in the Western Hemisphere. Our word is fiat in this territory. You need to sort of stick out of this. And Lord Salisbury looks at this sort of upstart nation making this comments that doesn't seem particularly powerful and says, the Monroe Doctrine has no standing in international law. You've got absolutely nothing to... And he basically ignores it. It's sort of very dismissive. And then Olney and Cleveland talk about, in another annual message, that the US may have to resort to force if the British don't sort of come to terms on this. And the US, as I say, had started to build up its navy in the 1890s, obviously no match for the British Empire, but the British Empire is faced with a whole range of different problems at the turn of the 20th century, whether it's the Boer War in South Africa, rising Germany, rising Japan in East Asia. And there's a huge amount of concern. And this is really one of the last times that the US and Britain come very close to coming to blows in a conflict. Huge amounts of jingoism on both sides in this boundary dispute. And ultimately, the British back down. And partly this is about Britain's sort of strategic position. But also, there's some in Britain who say, well, actually, if we're going to have to start making trade-offs, this is probably as good a place as any to start making a trade-off, because if the US will start policing its own Monroe Doctrine, then that will be in our interests. We can focus on other parts of the world. And so there's increasing encouragement from British diplomats and statesmen to the United States about doing this. And the Venezuelan boundary dispute, ultimately, Venezuela are very disappointed with what comes out of this. The British do agree to arbitration, but it's an arbitration that actually finds in Britain's interest. But the most important consequence of this is that the US has shown itself to be more assertive. In domestic politics, there's an increasing recognition. If we're going to sort of assert all of these principles, then we're going to have to actually get real about the power to do this. And for someone like Theodore Roosevelt, who's absolutely fundamental in the transformation of the Monroe Doctrine, this is a real signal moment that says, okay, we can no longer speak very loudly and carry a small stick to sort of turn his famous aphorism upside down. He's concerned that essentially the US is sort of bragging, but doesn't necessarily have the power to assert it. So that's when we start to see a shift in American politics in the late 1890s, that we need to get serious about defence and the defence of the hemisphere.
And Theodore Roosevelt, in his 1904 annual message to Congress, includes what he calls a corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. Can you tell us about this corollary and why it's significant?
Absolutely. And again, Venezuela comes into this again. So we have the Venezuelan debt crisis of 1902-1903, where the British and the Germans blockade Venezuela with an idea that essentially the Venezuelans owe debt. It seems a disorderly state, and there's fears that they will intervene. And Roosevelt, who had originally been quite concerned about the British, he actually, during the Venezuelan boundary dispute, in his sort of typical sort of blood and thunder way, talks about leading a cavalry charge into Canada. He wants to get all the European powers off of the American continent. But increasingly, he's come to recognize, as I mentioned, as the more savvy American statesmen of this era recognize, the British naval power is actually quite important for America's own security. He's much less willing to allow other European powers to maintain or to expand their presence in the region. So he ends up taking his own part in the drive to kick the Europeans off the continent in the Spanish-American War, his sort of crowded hour. And so Roosevelt plays a major role in that. And he sees the Monroe Doctrine being used during those debates over America's intervention in Cuba in an isolationist way. So there are many of the non-interventionists who say, we can't get involved in these sort of attacks on the Spanish Empire. We particularly can't take the Spanish colony of the Philippines in Asia because we are violating the Monroe Doctrine. And if we violate the Monroe Doctrine, the Europeans are going to get involved in our hemisphere. We need to sort of keep to our own hemisphere. And Roosevelt sort of turns this on its head with his corollary to the Monroe Doctrine and says, essentially, if we want to keep the Europeans out, there's a long history of us expanding. We are an expanding power. So we are a power that's going to expand regardless. And if we want to keep the Europeans out, it's not about these sort of self-denying ordinances. We need to get real about policing the hemisphere. We need to essentially, if the Venezuelans haven't paid their debt or any other power hasn't, or any other sort of Latin American nation hasn't paid their debt, then we may need to intervene to ensure that they do pay their debt, because otherwise the European powers are going to intervene. So it's almost an anti-colonial colonialism. It's like, keep the Europeans out. We have to start getting interventionists to bring that about.
And what is the outcome of Roosevelt's assertion of this international police power in the Western Hemisphere? Where and how did he seek to assert the United States power?
Again, one of the ironies of this is that Roosevelt's famous for his sort of speak softly and carry a big stick. But actually, with regard to his corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, we remember what he actually says with regard to it, but we don't actually remember that much about what he does. And there's a good reason for this, because actually the US is not massively interventionist during his own presidency after the corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. So the most important intervention actually occurs prior to the corollary being announced in 1904, and that's the acquisition of the territory around the Panama Canal, which for Roosevelt is absolutely fundamental to American strategic interest, the ability for the American Navy to move between the Atlantic and the Pacific. And that's really the most important reason why the US has also to intervene. It's to keep the Europeans out, but it's also to protect its own territory that it has started to acquire there. But actually, Roosevelt is not the most interventionist of presidents. And he comes under pressure at different times to intervene. There's one case in 1906 in Santo Domingo, where, again, the same sort of thing has happened, where there's debt that's owed to the Europeans and there's pressure on the Americans to intervene. And Roosevelt is very clear that this is not about formal imperialism. He has a wonderful phrase. He says, I have as much desire to annex that island as a boa constrictor would to swallow a porcupine. And Roosevelt does not want more territory. The idea is the US doesn't need these territories. He doesn't want to formally control them, but he does want to informally control their foreign policy and their geopolitics, because otherwise you're going to get the Europeans intervening. So for Roosevelt, the statement and the building up of the Navy is important, but he also recognises that the American public are not as interested as he is in these questions. So he's concerned, after his announcement of the corollary, that the American public aren't building up the Navy enough, that essentially the US is going to have to be very cautious about how it exercises this power, that the US has sort of signalled its intention to stop other powers intervening, but he's still concerned by the end of his presidency that not enough has been done to ensure that this doctrine, this corollary that he's invoked, is actually a living reality.
So when President Donald Trump today invokes the Monroe Doctrine, or the Donroe Doctrine as he called it, is he drawing on this kind of Rooseveltian tradition of interpreting the doctrine in a certain interventionist way?
I think there is very much a citing back to Roosevelt. I mean, there are certain superficial similarities between the two. I'm always sort of reminded of Theodore Roosevelt's daughter's famous line about him, that he wanted to be the sort of the bride at every wedding, the corpse at every funeral, this sort of like larger-than-life New Yorker. There's certainly that. I think Roosevelt was a sort of a more cosmopolitan figure, and was Roosevelt's corollary to the Monroe Doctrine went hand in hand with a belief that actually the US had a role more globally. This is also the time of the American arbitration of the Russo-Japanese War and the arbitration of the Franco-German dispute over Algeciras. So in that sense, again, there's sort of similarities. There's this sort of dominance in the Western Hemisphere, but actually the US's role as sort of this arbitrator of disputes around the world So that's only in terms of the sort of strategic posture of this. Obviously, at this time, for Roosevelt, the main focus is also on Europe and on the Atlantic. And so that's why he believes that the sort of connection with the British Empire is so important. Trump is obviously less focused on what's going on in the Atlantic, more concerned elsewhere. But where I'd say that there's a similarity in particular is this idea, which I think people tended to think with Roosevelt, that he was overinflating the threat from these European powers, that the Germans or the Japanese in Hawaii were going to start threatening the Monroe Doctrine. Now, we know from a lot of the material that's come out of the German archives subsequently that Kaiser Wilhelm II was very serious about this idea of expanding into the Western Hemisphere and seizing territory. And for Trump too, we see in Venezuela the encroachment of the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians. And I think the reason why there's similarities here and elsewhere across American history is that the US tends to forget about Latin America for long periods of time. But it's when sort of geopolitical competition gets fierce, when there's great power competition, there's a recognition that actually the Western Hemisphere is important to America's own security and also a huge strategic advantage. There's a reason that throughout history, other nations have wanted their own Monroe Doctrine. The Japanese, as they rise, talk about having a Monroe Doctrine in East Asia, a sort of a co-prosperity sphere. And there's a sense that, to go back to what I said at the beginning, that the US is blessed by geography. It has a much more preferable geopolitical position than that of almost any other power. And so throughout the history of rising powers, whether it's Germany under the Kaiser, whether it's Germany under the Nazis, whether it's the Japanese, whether it's the Chinese today, they want their own Monroe doctrines. So for all of these presidents that start to be concerned about geopolitical competition, you've got to protect America's backyard because that's America's great strategic advantage in its competition with other great powers.
And I think that plays into something that you identified earlier, which is that the Monroe Doctrine is very capacious. It is very flexible and it can be used for a variety of different purposes. And on that note, I just wondered whether the changing interpretation of the doctrine across the 19th century and the early 20th century also charts some of the changing perceptions of Latin American nations among the political leaders of the United States. Because the original annual message from the Monroe administration refers to the newly independent states of Latin America as Southern Brethren. But by the time of Theodore Roosevelt, there's perhaps a much more negative perception of these countries. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so it's tied up with this sort of language of civilization that Roosevelt has. There's a sense that the US is sort of a higher civilization. It's sort of laced through with the sort of imperial rhetoric of the era. So there's a part of Roosevelt's corollary that says that the US should sort of police the Western Hemisphere in the way that the European powers are sort of have their own empires, that essentially the US is the dominant power. He talks about sort of an international police power. And really, that's his sense that these are sort of disorderly states, that they need to almost be taught to a great extent the sort of English-speaking ways of doing democracy. So there's certainly a condescension towards them. But as I say, there's also a sense with Roosevelt that the US doesn't need these territories for its own economic interests. It needs them sort of geostrategically to keep other nations out. So he's less actually forceful than his words would suggest. But those that come after him are very interventionist, William Howard Taft, and particularly Woodrow Wilson, who intervenes in the Western Hemisphere more than almost any other president. There's a huge amount of intervention there, which then continues into the 1920s as well, with both Harding and Coolidge. And we start to see a shift in the late 1920s, the sort of emergence of sort of a good neighbor policy that Herbert Hoover and then Franklin Roosevelt engage in. And again, it's partly to do with this concern of what's going on in the rest of the world, the idea of keeping the Western Hemisphere as a more secure base. But the way of ensuring that that happens initially is that actually this is a less sort of American interventionist period of the 1930s. And it's really during the Second World War that we start to see Franklin Roosevelt talking about expanding the sort of Monroe Doctrine more broadly. It's during 1941 that Franklin Roosevelt talks about Greenland and the importance of it to American security. So again, it's event-driven in terms of what's going on. But to go back to your point about the sort of capacious nature of it, we see the same sort of things today with regard to the symbolism of the Monroe Doctrine. There are some who sort of see the Monroe Doctrine in the way that Theodore Roosevelt does, as sort of ensuring the sort of American domination of the Western Hemisphere, or at least the prevention of other powers coming in, as a basis for the US to act more assertively in the rest of the world. And there's others, and we see this with, say, the likes of the more non-interventionist figures in the United States, perhaps J.D. Vance or others, which is the idea that the Western Hemisphere is America's core strategic interest. And really, the Monroe Doctrine is about the US sort of being a less interventionist power, that the Western Hemisphere is where it sort of sets out its stall and the rest of the world is not one that it gets involved. So that's much more, to a certain extent, in keeping with what the original message of the Monroe Doctrine was, which was sort of like, we keep ourselves to the Western Hemisphere and the rest of the world keeps themselves away from it. Obviously, it's a more interventionist instrument than, say, Monroe and Quincy Adams could potentially have envisaged at that time because they didn't have the power. But really, there's multiple different Monroe doctrines and there's multiple different corollaries to that doctrine. And Trump's is only the latest iteration of this.
And you mentioned both Presidents Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Delano Roosevelt there. I just wanted to ask you, what happens to the idea of the Monroe Doctrine as the United States becomes a global superpower in the wake of the Second World War and during the early Cold War?
Yes, well, during the First War and the Second World War, there's a sense to which the emergence of a more sort of pact-based nature to the Monroe Doctrine, a sort of a more multilateral nature, which Wilson sort of starts to move to after his more sort of interventionist era, particularly around Mexico, Haiti, Dominican Republic, but starts to talk about sort of a Pan-American pact. And we see similar things with Roosevelt. And the idea is that the Monroe Doctrine almost becomes a model for what the US will do elsewhere in the world. But it's not necessarily always one that Latin American nations are particularly keen on. So when the Monroe Doctrine is sort of folded into the League of Nations, there's a concern in Latin America that this is not the Monroe Doctrine of the sort of the Latin American mutual pact with the United States. It's more a Monroe Doctrine of an interventionist doctrine, which is sort of born out in the 1920s. And that's the same sort of thing that during the Second World War, that Roosevelt and many of the actors who were involved in the in Franklin Roosevelt's cabinet, who had worked on Latin America, then become involved in the sort of the United Nations movement. And there's a sense of a sort of multilateral expansion out of a Latin American model for the good neighbor policy towards the United Nations. But what we see during the Cold War is that the Monroe Doctrine isn't really invoked quite as much. It sort of falls out of the popular consciousness. And partly, as I say, because the idea with the Monroe Doctrine in its essence was, we'll keep to our side of the world, you keep to yours. And in a time where the US is a global power, it seems less relevant. There's some members of John F. Kennedy's cabinet who talk about invoking the Monroe Doctrine with regard to Cuba. And Kennedy sort of says to them, like, the Monroe Doctrine, what's that? Like, and he doesn't mean, Kennedy is a historically aware president, but he's almost sort of speaking for the average American, that the idea is the Monroe Doctrine has sort of lost its sort of salience that it had in the 19th and the early 20th century. There's a bit of a revival of it during the Reagan administration, where we sort of see the interventions in Grenada, and then later with the Panamanian intervention and the sort of George H.W. Bush period. But the idea really at that point is that the Monroe Doctrine is sort of a supplement to this sort of more global posture. And it's only really in recent years that some of those who want to move to sort of a more hemispheric defense posture initially sort of re-upped the Monroe Doctrine as a sense of saying, well, actually, this is where our core interests lie. We've been sort of going all over the world in terms of nation building, but actually our main security is about what's going on in Latin America, migration, drugs, interventions from great powers. This is sort of very 19th century conception of America's place in the world. Now, it's not clear that that's President Trump's conception of it. His one may be one that combines that idea of a more 19th century element, but grafted on to a belief that the US is going to act in a global way. And so the interventions that we've seen, air power interventions, whether that's Nigeria, whether that's other parts of the world, in that sense, that's still a belief that the US will police the rest of the world as well, but it will do so alongside a dominance of the Western Hemisphere. But it's certainly the case that we're back to a world where that is the fundamentals of America's defensive posture. And as I say, that is something which the United States, it is blessed by geography in a way that other powers aren't, that it has these sort of two massive moats on either side, with the Pacific and the Atlantic, relatively weak neighbours to the north and to the south. But this is a posture that the Chinese could only dream about when you look at the Chinese position in East Asia. So it, to a certain extent, this is just natural, quite savvy strategy to sort of focus back on the Western Hemisphere.
So it would be easy perhaps to dismiss Donald Trump's remarks as just something quite eccentric. However, it seems to me that you're saying there is a kind of consistency here. Perhaps it's not a conscious consistency. And that actually a Monroeist tradition or a Monroeist foreign policy is actually consistent with the kind of multipolar order that's emerging, with different powers asserting their own spheres of interest and influence.
I think that's right. I think the irony is the Monroe Doctrine emerges in a response to the Holy Alliance of the what occurs in Europe. There have been some who've talked about sort of a new Holy Alliance that the United States might be part of, with China, Russia, India, these nations having their own spheres of influence, sort of a return to that aspect of 19th century geopolitics. And that would be certainly a big idea. It would be very different, and that would be very different to what we've seen before in terms of the US's conception of itself alongside other players in that way. Although, to a certain extent, this is also in line with something that Franklin Roosevelt, the ideas that he had during the Second World War about sort of four policemen policing their spheres of influence in the world. So, yes, I think there is a lot of this which feels quite familiar to historians of the 19th century and the early 20th century. Obviously, though, in an era of vast technological change and competition over natural resources and minerals, which is part of the reason why Latin America, again, has become significant as well in terms of its the importance of resources and minerals, part of the reason why Greenland in the Western Hemisphere, the access to sort of rare earths, that's part of this larger geopolitical competition. But the other thing that I would say in terms of the Monroe Doctrine as symbolism, part of the reason why the Monroe Doctrine has been sort of revived by the Trump administration is really that this sort of speaks to the heart of America's conception of it, of its own security as well. It's much easier to sell interventions against drugs and illegal immigration in Latin America than it is to sell interventions on the other side of the world. I mean, this is something which the American public recognize, the sort of strategic interest that the United States have in what's going on in Venezuela, the concern of hostile powers getting into the Caribbean basin and making the United States's position less tolerable. That, from a political perspective, is a much easier sell than, say, intervention in the Middle East. So again, the political symbolism of this is important, but it's also tied to very real strategic interests.
I'm glad you mentioned the Middle East, because obviously we have seen Iran roiled by new popular protests in recent weeks. And the Trump administration is obviously weighing up whether to intervene to try and tip the balance in favor of the protesters against the regime. Does the Trump administration see the Middle East as part of an American sphere of influence, like the Western Hemisphere? Or does it think about this part of the world in a fundamentally different way?
It is very interesting with President Trump, who sort of came to office with this opposition to sort of previous American interventions in the Middle East, his concern that sort of blood and treasure had been sort of squandered in the Middle East, of sort of do-gooder interventionism, and particularly ideas about regime change. Whereas now, obviously, he feels much more comfortable rhetorically talking about regime change, which we started to see in response to the Iranian nuclear issue last summer. Now, this is Iran, obviously, as a nuclear actor, poses a much greater strategic threat to the United States. And I think President Trump recognizes that. That's part of what occurred with Operation Midnight Hammer last year, but also a sense of what Iran constitutes as part of sort of a threat to the broader region. It's targeting of American troops in the Middle East, and its spread of terrorism across the region, its sort of domination of the Levant in the last decade or so, although obviously that has been rolled back since October the 7th. I think what we see in the Middle East is Trump's belief that sort of air power can be effective in sort of deterring hostile actors. It's not clear that this sort of expands out to an idea of a far more interventionist posture there. I mean, I don't think that the Middle East enjoys anywhere near the same sort of strategic significance as the Western Hemisphere or even as East Asia in this current Trump administration's posture, sort of understandably. But I don't think that's to rule out the possibility of strikes and particularly of proxy actors like Israel acting if Iran's direction is potentially sort of hostile. But one thing which I will say about that, in terms of the link back to an earlier period, it's in the same message that Theodore Roosevelt outlines his corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. He outlines what I've christened Roosevelt's second corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which is that when crimes against civilization are committed around the world, the United States has some interest and a sense of responsibility to do something about them. And Roosevelt really was the first person to articulate this. And it was really picked up at the time in Europe, who were very concerned, particularly in Russia, with their maltreatment of Russian Jews, were sending sort of floods of migrants away from Russia to the United States. It was also in the Ottoman Empire with the persecution of Armenian Christians. And so I think there is an aspect of that within Trump's conception of this as well, the bombing of Nigeria on behalf of Christians. This would seem familiar to many of the European statesmen of the early 20th century who were concerned about American gunships in the Eastern Mediterranean against the Ottoman Empire. So I think what we see with Trump is similar to Roosevelt, a marrying of dominance in the Western Hemisphere is the most important strategic posture, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the United States doesn't get involved in events elsewhere in the world. And I think there's been probably too much of a sense in Europe in the last couple of weeks that a sort of a reasserted Monroe Doctrine is about sort of a US that is less interested in some other aspects around the world. And I don't think that the two naturally follow on from each other.
So is there in Trump's thinking a sort of similar, shall we say, skepticism about European entanglements as well, and also an anxiety about European political culture, at least at the elite level?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we see, and certainly for some in the Trump administration, is that these things potentially do go hand in hand. So the idea of sort of an expanded Monroe Doctrine that might encompass Greenland is sort of seen not necessarily as a problem that the Europeans are against this, but potentially potential upside to this, because it actually undermines aspects of sort of transatlantic bonds and the US's sort of presence there. So and I'm not saying that's the view of the president himself, but there are certainly some in his camp that aren't particularly concerned that the Europeans are alarmed about what's going on with Greenland. Actually, in some senses, this has some benefits for America's strategic posture. I think what we see, though, with regard to the Monroe Doctrine as it was articulated under Theodore Roosevelt, is that the weather was being made from Europe. Europe was the dominant actor in international affairs. Today, from the American perspective, it's Europe's weakness that is the issue here, that is actually that the US has to sort of be onshore in Europe, and that's what they don't want. I mean, they're certainly not concerned about European encroachments, Western European encroachments into the Western Hemisphere in the way that they were in the 19th century. The threats are coming from the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians. I think from Trump's perspective, it goes hand in hand with a more sort of 19th century idea about avoiding sort of entangling alliances in the way that Thomas Jefferson conceives of it. And so the Monroe Doctrine is about American unilateralism, dominance in the Western Hemisphere. This is about a unilateral American posture in the world, and that other states can choose to go along, but this is not about sort of tying down the American Gulliver in these sort of pacts where Lilliputian nations, as they would see it, get to sort of set the American agenda. This is about American unilateralism. And so in that sense, this is about a sort of a 19th century conception, but backed by a far more overwhelming power than the US ever had in the 19th century.
And I wondered whether you could talk about how technology and energy fit into this, because Trump has spoken about the idea of a golden dome for the United States, for example, and many analysts have suggested, well, that would require control of Greenland, for example. He's also spoken about bringing down energy prices to sort of ramp up the US's ability to compete with China, and particularly compete with China at the technological frontier. And obviously this has implications for the intervention in Venezuela. So could you please talk about how those two points fit into Trump's foreign policy and his bid for supremacy in the Western Hemisphere?
Yeah, I think the technological aspect, again, is similar in the late 19th century, sort of a move towards sort of steam and the sense that the world is shrinking plays a role in America being much more assertive in the Western Hemisphere. And I think we're seeing that as well, the sense of like sort of a smaller world, that there's a sort of a technological aspect to sort of the shift in sort of space power, and Greenland being significant in this respect, that the threats to the United States are brought back in that way. But Trump also has a much more sort of acquisitive, mercantilistic attitude to interventions, both personal and national, which again is sort of in line with sort of a 19th century conception of interventions, that any intervention, as he talked about in his campaign in 2016, that his, from his perspective, the stupid thing about what the US did in Iraq is that it didn't take the oil. Well, that's something which we saw. And we've seen this sort of repeatedly with Trump. If you even go back into the 80s, there was a sense that if it was going to get involved in any interventions in the Middle East, say against Iran during the Iran-Iraq war, the oil was going to be sort of a prize that the United States would take out of this. Now, of course, the United States, the world has shifted technologically in terms of America's need for this oil. Marco Rubio has sort of made this point again and again. Like, the United States doesn't necessarily need access to this oil. It's more concerned about depriving other nations from gaining access to this. But from Trump's perspective, interventions should have very sort of clear acquisitive benefits to the United States and potentially to him personally. And so these interventions in Latin America have that benefit to them in terms of accessing oil. And in that sense, probably are more similar to the sort of interventions that we start to see in the 1920s, where resources are a big part, the sort of like dollar diplomacy that William Howard Taft talks about, that economic benefits to the United States should accrue from these interventions. So again, this is not completely new in terms of the history of the United States and the hemisphere. I mean, Greenland in particular, we're going to sort of like talk about the security aspects. Trump is not the first American president to talk about acquiring Greenland. Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower both wanted to purchase Greenland for security reasons. From Trump's perspective, it seems to be a combination of these security factors, partly sort of a real estate mentality that sees sort of a territory that's sort of capacious and has sort of access to these resources. That's from sort of Trump's perspective, the two things sort of marry. So security, technological, and resource extraction all go hand in hand from his perspective.
And what are the implications for America's allies? Are they going to simply have to get with the program, or do you think we'll see them try to create their own kind of balance between this new sort of 19th century style, as you put it, American hegemon and other very powerful actors on the international stage, whether that is China or an emerging India?
To a certain extent, I think some of the lessons that Theodore Roosevelt was trying to sort of preach to the United States in the late 1890s actually have real salience to Europe today, that in a world of great power competition, in an era of acquisitive predatory powers, the main thing that you have to look out for is your own security and your own defense, that you can't rely on any other nation to defend you. Roosevelt started to realize that with regard to the British Empire, that America's interests were not going to be sort of protected forever by the British, and that the US had to get real about its own defense. It needed naval power, but it also needed the ability to protect its own borders. And I think from a European perspective, that is a fundamental lesson that is sort of long past learned. But Roosevelt also talked about this idea that sort of speak softly and carry a big stick, don't draw unless you mean to shoot, was another one of his aphorisms. And I think the avoidance of sort of highfalutin rhetoric that can't be backed by military force is a really important lesson in a particularly dangerous era. So Europe, I think at the moment, is in a very precarious position. It doesn't necessarily have the power, even if it wanted to sort of keep the US out of, say, something like Greenland. So that puts it in a very difficult strategic position. I don't think the US is going to militarily intervene in Greenland. There's certainly a desire to acquire this, but I think it's sort of economic pressure that's going to be the most important factor here. But I do think that the Europeans have to learn some of those sort of late 19th century lessons again, that essentially the basis of the order that the Europeans and which we in Britain have benefited from a number of years, relied on overwhelming power to safeguard this as well. And in an era when that power may not be directed towards the values and interests that Europeans hold, then essentially, if we're going to continue to believe in those values, want to espouse them, which I think these are important and good values, but they need to be backed up by force, particularly in a more dangerous world.
So looking back on the two centuries that have passed since 1823, what explains the significance that is still invested into Monroe's words? You spoke about it as being the Monroe Doctrine with capital letters. Why does it still hold such symbolic power in the minds and geopolitical imagination of many Americans?
I think partly because it has never really been the Monroe Doctrine in that sense. It has always been a very sort of broad-based idea that could be invested with the meaning of those who championed it. It's something which has huge political symbolism, certainly in the 19th century, and is now coming back as a doctrine with significance. But it's one that different actors can choose to interpret in the manner in which they want. So more non-interventionist figures can sort of find what they want in it, with an idea that the US sort of keeps itself to itself. Those who want to sort of dominate the Western Hemisphere can point to particular corollaries as the sort of basis of this. But that it also is something for those who want a more global posture. They don't necessarily need to say, okay, the American sort of dominant role in the Western Hemisphere replaces an American global role, because it didn't for Theodore Roosevelt, it didn't for Woodrow Wilson or Franklin Roosevelt. So the idea is that this is a doctrine, or at least a set of ideas, that really just comes back to the idea of an American sort of dominant space, a favorable geographical position, and in particular, a desire to keep other hostile actors far from its shores. So in that sense, the breadth of it is what explains its appeal. It's something which will be picked up by all manner of different actors. And as I say, there have been times where people have, whether that was sort of John Kerry during the Obama administration, sort of talked about the demise of the Monroe Doctrine, that the US was sort of like returning to sort of some of those sort of good neighbor ideas of the late 1920s. But as I think, as we see from the sort of the Donald Trump administration, the idea of the demise of the Monroe Doctrine has been greatly exaggerated. And we are back to an era where the Monroe Doctrine, in a more assertive form, the more sort of Roosevelt corollary elements of this, has been updated for the 21st century.
Thank you very much, Charlie.
It's been a pleasure to join you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow, rate, and review the show. And find our writing at www.engelsbergideas.com.